Hey, this is Joe. I'm watching the Bears game, and you're listening to Mike Steven on Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Joe. Yeah, go Bears. I'll tell you, it's been a little while since we were in the playoffs, you know. Here we go. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 1004. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. So hello to Bob. And here we go, as we are now getting into 2026. And in case you didn't know, this is an election year. Yeah, the midterms are happening in November, although not every office is up for election this year. In fact, the Chicago mayor's race isn't until February of 2027. But that doesn't mean that we're not in the political season around here. Recently, Congressman Mike Quigley announced that he's running to be the next mayor of Chicago. Congressman Quigley has a long relationship with your friends here at Outside the Loop. The first time I interviewed him was back in 2008. Yeah, during the Outside the Loop second anniversary party recorded at Toon's Bar and Grill in Lakeview. That's back when Mike Quigley was a Cook County Board Commissioner. Okay, so he's running for mayor, but here's the catch. Quigley is a Packers fan. I know. Earlier this week, he said, quote, "I grew up with my father being a Vince Lombardi fan, and you got to stay loyal. You have to be honest with yourself and the public. We are what we are in large part because of our parents and our family. If I was to tell you something otherwise, I'd lose respect for myself and from others as well," end quote. All right, so Quigs is a Packers fan. I got to say, I respect his honesty, though. He's sticking with his guns. I mean, I like to think if I happen to be running for elected office up in Green Bay somewhere or northern Wisconsin or just anywhere in Wisconsin, I would say, hey, look, I'm a Bears fan and I have to be. That's who I am. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I'd like to think that this kind of thing won't impact voters, but if you look at the history of Chicago, I don't know. A lot of politicians and judges were voted into office around here based on the ethnicity of their last names. I mean, for a while, the joke was if you had an Irish last name, you were definitely going to be a judge. So here's something interesting. A Packers fan going up against a deeply unpopular mayor, what would happen? Now, I know that there are probably going to be other folks who throw their hats in the ring for the mayor's office, but a Packers fan versus an unpopular mayor like Mayor Johnson, his approval rating is pretty bad. I've seen figures as low as 6% approval to 14% approval. And those are just pretty wretched numbers. So I don't know how this is going to shake out. I mean, if we fast forward to next year and the election happens and Mike Quigley somehow ekes out a victory, would that be the first time that a Chicago mayor would be an official Packers fan, at least publicly? I'd have to do some digging on that, but I would just off the top of my dome say, yeah, probably. But look, this is 2026. Who knows what's going to happen 2025? All kinds of things went down. It was a roller coaster of sorts, but hey, at least we were together, right? And we are together today. We've got a great show coming up for you, so stick around and let me just say one more time, go Bears. Imagine going to work and eventually expecting a paycheck. Sounds pretty normal, right? But that paycheck never shows up. You'd probably just assume take your employer to court, But when you do that, you find that it could take years before the money that you are owed shows up. This nightmare scenario is a reality for thousands of workers in our state. A new report sheds light on how Illinois failed to collect wages owed to workers in Cook County and how this kind of wage theft continues. Alejandra Cancino is a senior investigative reporter at Injustice Watch. That's a local nonprofit newsroom that reports on our court system, and she is here with us today. Alejandra, welcome back to the show. Nice to talk to you again.
It's so nice to be here with you.
So you wrote this report and you did a lot of digging here. And the scenario that I just described might seem like an impossibility for some of us listening, but this really happens. So can you give us a little bit more of a detailed explanation? Because what this comes down to is really an employer just not paying their workers.
Yeah, this is, and thank you so much for highlighting the story. So what I was really interested in, and first of all, understanding what is wage theft, right? Like I have been lucky enough not to have experienced that in the past, but when you talk to low-wage workers in Chicago, you hear a lot of them tell you stories about times in which they work for a restaurant, they work for a staffing agency, they work, you know, for someone who told them, offered them money to help them fix a bathroom or that kind of work, mm-hmm. and then they didn't get paid. And so I wanted to know, well, what happens with the thousands of complaints that are filed with the state every year. So Illinois has really strong labor laws. And I thought when I first started researching the story that, you know, we were going to be the good example of things that are going well in the state. And I was really surprised to find out that at the end of the road, right, like there's a whole process. So it starts with the worker filing this claim with the state. And then if the claim has validity, it goes through the administrative law judge, essentially through the process, and an administrative judge who decides whether or not the worker is owed money. And then after that, if the employer refuses to pay, that's when you get the state's attorney's office to get involved and eventually can sue the employer to recoup the money. And I was really curious to understand what happens at that point, because in my mind, that is sort of the limits of the law, right? Like, so we say that we have this really strong laws, but are we enforcing the laws to be able to get workers paid at the end of the day?
Right. And you go into that process and you explained it a little bit there of what happens when someone says, hey, I don't think I'm getting my money or I'm getting shortchanged. They can go to the state because, as you report here, Alejandra, there are laws on the books in Illinois that are supposed to protect workers. And so if someone says, hey, I'm owed money, I need this money, this is really important, they can go to the state. But often what happens is in that process, there's a lot of bureaucracy. It takes a long time. Sometimes people disappear, like the employers can't be found. And for all of the protections that are in place, what was surprising to me in reading what you reported was that, hey, this is very dangerous for so many people who are low-wage workers who can get used, and there's no recourse or very little recourse for these folks.
It was really heartbreaking for me to talk to some of the workers I spoke with. I spoke to a woman who used to clean high-end stores downtown Chicago, and she talked to me about how the economic impact of not getting paid. It was huge for her, but it was also her sense of worth, right? She felt that she was doing she took such pride in cleaning the stores downtown and not being paid was just heartbreaking for her. She fell behind on bills. Most of the workers that I spoke with said the same thing, right? It's like a snowball effect for them. They don't get paid. They live paycheck to paycheck. So what that means is that they are not able to pay the bills. Sometimes they choose not to pay some bills to be able to continue to pay the ones that they need the most, like their housing. But in some cases, some have ended up having to move out of their apartments, have ended up in eviction court because they didn't get paid.
And it is heartbreaking. And you have a few of these stories in this report, which is up at injusticewatch.org. And I think it's important to call this out here. You know, we've mentioned that these jobs are typically low wage jobs. So people who are, like you said, are cleaning department stores or who are doing sort of odd jobs or helping out in restaurants. And there is also this intersection with immigrants. And I know immigration was something we've talked a lot about in 2025. But look, this is something that we look at and we say, hey, here's an example of folks who come to this country. They're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to help out. They just want to get paid. And this is also disproportionately impacting immigrants as well.
Yeah, this is another one of the things that was surprising to me is when I talked to experts, they said to me that, and it makes sense after you start hearing about it, right, is that immigrants are disproportionately impacted because a lot of the times they're working under the table. They don't have a contract. They're just taking the word of the employer. And a lot of the times they just don't, even when they're working above board, they don't want to cause anything that might get them in trouble, right? Like they're afraid of immigration authorities, they're afraid of local police authorities, so they just don't feel like they have the ability to complain about it. So oftentimes they just walk away. I mean, we know about the people who report their wages being stolen, and that's a number of about 5,000 cases per year. But we also know from the experts that there are thousands more who don't even report that their wages have been stolen.
Right, because in their mind, they might be afraid. And also, this is amazing too, if you're an employer and if you're just a really not nice person, you might know, hey, this person, I have the leverage here. Like, what's this employee or this worker that I'm saying I'm going to pay? They're not going to complain. So I could just have them do the work and then I could skip town or I could change my number. And really, I have the upper hand here. So despite, again, what's amazing to me is despite the laws that are on the books in the state of Illinois, the worker is really getting the short end of the stick here.
Yeah. And so once we started, you know, a lot of what we were trying to do is try to figure out, okay, how long does it really take? Can we put some numbers, some real findings into how long is it taking? And so we measure from the time in which from the date in which the worker filed a claim with the state to when our lawsuit was filed. And that could take 3 years on average. And then after that, that's not the end, right? Like that's just the beginning of a case in court. And then after that, it could take an additional 2 years for the case to have some kind of resolution, being either a settlement or the state can choose to dismiss the case, because in one particular case that we profile, one of the employers had died and the second owner of the company just couldn't be found by the state. And so the case was dismissed 5 years after the worker had told the state that her wages had gotten stolen. And even when we looked further into cases that hadn't been settled, we realized that a lot of the times what a settlement meant was that the employer agreed to pay on a monthly basis X amount of money for X amount of time. And oftentimes employers just stop paying halfway through. And so along the way, the state had to come back into court and take that employer back to court, which could be many years later. One of the cases that we looked into had been open for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
And the workers still hadn't been fully compensated.
That's amazing. I mean, we know that the justice system does not move quickly, but on the average here, basically waiting 5 years to get paid. And this isn't just like a couple hundred bucks. In some cases, I know you profile someone who's owed about $30,000, but right, to wait 5 years in order to get paid that money, that's just not feasible for a lot of people. And as you're saying, that a lot of these workers are living paycheck to paycheck. So as you say here, the road to justice is long. And like you were talking about, even when employers agree to pay, sometimes they can't be found or they don't get the full amount of money here. So this is just a really, I think, kind of messed up system that we have here. And something that you focus on here is the backlog in the system. There is just the sheer volume of claims. And I just want to focus on that here because there are thousands of these claims that are filed with the Department of Labor at the state level. And it seems that from what you're reporting here, there just aren't enough people working at the state to be able to handle this. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a backlog here. Can you explain what's happening?
Yeah. And so in the reporting, I learned a little bit about the backlog is not new, right? It has been happening for many years, including during the Rauner administration, wherein the number of people who work at the Department of Labor was a lot lower than the number of people who are working there now. And so you have this like year over year backlog of cases that they just didn't, there's just not enough people that are able to go through them. So that's one part of the problem, right? So right now we have less than a dozen people who are reviewing these thousands of complaints that are filed every year. And so, you know, the Department of Labor has tried and they did speak about the efforts that they've tried over time to be able to deal with this, right? And so they created last year a program to try to resolve some of these cases with like where the worker is alleging that the employer only owes them a few hundred dollars to move them more quickly so they can get to the other ones more quickly. But still, right, like that still doesn't solve the issue and it still doesn't solve the fact that workers are waiting for a long time from the workers' perspective, right? Waiting 6 months or even 3 months after they were supposed to get paid, it's a long time.
Yeah, and I know in your reporting here, again, this is up at injusticewatch.org, you talked to someone who was advocating for workers' rights for decades, for 50 years, and he said that the problem is really the system itself. There is an intense bureaucracy. There is a lot of complexity. And so if you're a worker and you maybe you really don't have resources or many resources, when you try to navigate this system, it's so complicated that people just don't know where to start. And so like we said before, maybe they don't start. But when you get into the system, after a while, you feel like you get lost. That's a serious problem that, you know, I would think that we would want to look at, you know?
Yeah, Jorge Mujica, who has been a long-term labor organizer in the city, he actually deals with a lot of workers who come to him and they're just like, we don't know how to file. Even the fact how to file the complaint with the Department of Labor is really difficult. Like one of the examples that he gave me was that in the form that you need to file for the request, it asks for who is paying you and whether the person who's paying you is a different person from the person who is employing you. And he was saying a lot of the times workers don't know. I mean, they just get hired by someone and they know that John Smith is the person who hired them, but they don't really know who the owner of the company is, right? Like they know that they're getting a paycheck every month and at some point they didn't get it. And that's what they know.
Which is amazing. And again, I go back to this. You know, looking at the employer here, because we've been talking about the workers and obviously our hearts go out to them when you read a report like this. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And you have a few stories of people who were impacted by this kind of wage theft. And I feel, again, like, you know, in terms of what to do about this at the state level, do we really go after these employers? And I say that, but then after reading this report, it's so easy, I feel like, for the employers to kind of get around all these regulations or to just disappear or to fade into the crowd and maybe do this again. You know, in terms of what do we do about this? I don't know. And so I want to ask you about your thoughts on this, because you're looking at these reports. You've gone through thousands of these cases. Should we be trying to penalize the employers who are thinking about doing something like this kind of wage theft?
So one of the questions that I had for the experts when I was speaking with them, I was like, well, do we need a stronger laws? And they were like, well, okay, so there are other states in the nation that do have stronger laws that criminalize wage theft, for example. But then they were pointing out to like, well, the question is whether the state is using the power of the current laws that it has. Because they were saying, you know, Alejandro, like even if we created laws that were even stronger, what's the point of those stronger laws if we're not using everything that we have in our toolbox right now? And so that made me wonder about that. How do we measure? How do we understand whether the state is using all of the tools at its disposal in court? And so what we ended up doing is looking at the court dockets, essentially, trying to figure out, well, what are some of the tools that we have, and is the state using them? So one of the tools, for instance, is that if the employer doesn't comply with a court order, the state can ask the judge to issue a warrant for the employer's arrest. And I wonder, well, how many times are we using that? And we found that the state really rarely uses that tool. Hmm. I couldn't find an instance in the last 9 years where the state actually asked a judge for the warrant of an employer who just wasn't compliant with court orders. I mean, if you think about it from the criminal court perspective, how often can someone accused of a felony just simply not comply with a court order?
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing when you think of it like that, that we have tools at our disposal, but we're not using them. The state is deciding to not use all those. I know that you reached out to Kwame Raoul, the Attorney General of Illinois, and he did not go on the record for this report, but what did you hear from the Attorney General's office? Because that's, in my mind, that's who we should be looking at, right? As the chief law enforcement officer for the state?
So we did speak to Attorney General Kwame Raoul. He declined our request to interview him. In an email statement, he did say that his office works diligently to enforce all labor laws. And that during his time as an Attorney General, and even as a member of the Illinois Senate, he has actively endeavored to support workers' rights. I mean, I will tell you that we tried really hard to get him to speak with us. We really wanted to sit down with him and explain how we had arrived to our conclusions, and that we were really disappointed that he just didn't agree to the interview.
Yeah, and I after reading this, I am too, you know, because this is something that I think our leaders here at the state level need to look into. And, you know, just kind of thinking big picture here, Alejandra, here we are in a place right now in a period of time where, you know, we have a presidential administration that is really trying to weaken federal labor laws and regulations across the United States. And here in Illinois, we have a bunch of those and we're still going through this, but also with the immigration enforcement. And we talked about how immigrant workers really don't have a ton of resources and leverage on their part. So, I mean, this is really a big issue in Illinois, but also just looking big picture across the United States, you know, we have to keep that in mind because that's kind of the backdrop for what's going on. If we think that this is a problem now, who knows what's coming down the pipeline where we could see wage theft even increase in the future?
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that is sort of one of the reasons that we look into this now. Like, why write about this now? And the reasons why I think it's important right now is because we have a federal administration that has been actively tinkering with workers' rights, right? And so when at the federal level, when we don't have a strong laws, then we look at the states to see what the states are doing and how the states are enforcing those laws. It's extremely important right now.
Well, this report, I think, is important to read, to understand that this is happening in our state of Illinois. And hopefully this kind of causes some people to jump into action here and take a second look at what's going on with workers. And this report is up on the website injusticewatch.org. It is called Illinois Fails to Collect Wages Owed to Workers in Cook County. And it is written by Alejandra Cancino, who is a senior investigative reporter at Injustice Watch. That's a local nonprofit newsroom that reports on our court system. Alejandra, as always, thank you so much for talking to us. And your reporting here is excellent. Thank you for all of your hard work on it. And I'm sure we will be talking again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As we roll into 2026, let's think about the fiscal health of Illinois. There's a new report out right now from the University of Illinois Institute on Public Affairs called Current Condition and Future Concerns for Growth in Illinois State Revenue. This report highlights emerging challenges in Illinois state revenue streams and potential impacts of federal policy changes on the state's fiscal future. Paula Worthington is a collaborating scholar on this report. She is also a senior policy advisor at the Civic Federation, and she joins us today here on Outside the Loop. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, nice to talk to you. So this report, there's a lot of information in there. So what we'll do here is try to simplify some of this for our listeners. So broadly speaking, you looked back here. One of the things you looked at was fiscal year 2025. Overall, with regards to revenue performance in the state of Illinois, how did we do?
The report basically finds that revenue growth has slowed somewhat relative to sort of long-term trends, and in particular, elevated what's been going on with sales tax revenues, because they too have been slowing down in terms of their growth. They're growing a little more slowly than their long-term growth rate, and that's an area that we think deserves paying attention to in the years ahead.
So in terms of that right there, the sales tax, I mean, that's been, I think, kind of a topic of conversation where we debate how much of that should we have. But are you saying here that is that one of the most important things that we look at in terms of that revenue and what the state is bringing in a fiscal year?
Sure. I mean, for many purposes, we focus on own source revenues that include sales taxes, individual income taxes, and corporate income taxes. And for the state of Illinois, those three are the big three. So what we sort of tease apart in this report to some extent is, you know, what's been happening with sales taxes, which I already said a little bit about. Mm-hmm. And then on the income tax side, basically what we see is evidence of what looked to be kind of large swings on the individual side and the corporate side, individual going up a lot, corporate going down a lot. But the fact is that some of that is actually just making up for some reclassification of dollars in that could have, should have, would have been correctly categorized as individual and said it was corporate and vice versa. So they're getting that sorted out. Broadly construed, overall, income tax revenues look pretty good. So those three components, sales, individual income, corporate income, are the key sources one looks at when thinking about growth in your the revenues that come into the state regularly.
So that's one aspect of this report. And something else that you go into, and I know that you specifically were working on this in great detail, an area that we look at here is medical provider taxes. There were some changes in the rules governing these taxes, which we'll get to in a little bit here. But first of all, just explain it to us if you can. What are medical provider taxes and why do we look at those? Why are they important?
Sure. Great question. So Illinois, like many states, uses what they call medical provider taxes, that is levies on hospitals, managed care organizations, long-term care facilities, other entities like that in the medical sector. And it levies these taxes on those entities as a way of providing additional revenue that can be used to fund the state's Medicaid program. And the order of magnitude of these so-called provider taxes is pretty large. Yes, the state relies also on those state and income taxes to provide revenues for the Medicaid program, but these provider tax revenues are also pretty significant. In fiscal year 2025, those taxes accounted for generated about $4.7 billion in revenue. And that is revenue that was then used to help the state cover expenses associated with the Medicaid program.
Can you explain for us what is changing here? Why is this a little different, and why should we think about this?
In a nutshell, states have been allowed to levy these taxes for some time with an understanding that the taxes need to be broad-based. They can't just single out certain kinds of providers. So it has to be on all hospitals or managed care organizations. And the rates have to be relatively low, max rate of 6% prior to the passage of HR 1. States could then levy those taxes, use the dollars to fund Medicaid program expenditures, attract matching federal funds, and then recycle those dollars into their programs. So what the legislation does is basically tell states, you can keep doing that, but you can never have a maximum tax rate of 6%. The so-called safe harbor tax rate cap is going to decrease starting on October 1st, 2027. And it's going to decrease in half percentage point increments until it reaches 3.5% a few years down the line. So basically, states are being told you can no longer tax at 5.5-6%. You're going to have to bring the tax rate down. And that has direct implications for the kind of revenue the state will be able to raise from that mechanism.
Right. So if we're saying that these taxes, these medical provider taxes, this is being used to really fund Medicaid in the state of Illinois. And if the government, and this was the, you mentioned HR 1, this was also known as the one big, beautiful bill that got a lot of attention. So that's what we're talking about here. If in this bill, we're saying, okay, you must now reduce the amount of taxes that you're bringing in from these medical providers, a few years down the road, we cannot fund Medicaid in the same way. And the implication there is these people that were relying on Medicaid, you know, what do they do?
Right. And specifically, again, Illinois was one of many states organizing themselves this way. But specifically, they would take those provider tax revenues and the matching, corresponding matching federal funds, and they would use those resources to make directed payments to certain kinds of providers in the ecosystem, safety net hospitals, critical care facilities, institutions that provided services to Medicaid-covered populations. And so it's those payments that now are going to be harder to make because you have this downward pressure on the tax revenues that are being used to fund them. And so that has implications for, you know, the fiscal well-being of these providers themselves.
So thinking about this long term here, because these days, sometimes that's hard to do. We're so focused on short term, what's going on this week or next week. But this is something that, again, kicks in next year, fiscal year 2027. So this reduces the that cap. It reduces it in small increments here. So thinking long term, there are some things that are being kicked around here that the state of Illinois could do, because if we look long term, we're saying that, well, fewer people are going to be able to benefit from Medicaid at this point if we extrapolate this. So what is the state of Illinois thinking about doing here looking forward?
Sure. That is a great question. These provider tax changes look like they really will not be sort of in our faces and truly pushing things around until our state fiscal year 2028. So we have a little runway there. Mm-hmm. So that's encouraging. I do think the state is probably very focused in the short run on other tax changes that might make sense to consider in light of this HR 1, because HR 1 affected not just medical provider taxes, but other aspects of the Medicaid program, the SNAP program, as well as changes to corporate and individual income taxation. So I think the state will very much focus on the tax code pieces in the short run. I think that they are also working hard to tee up appropriate systems and processes to implement some of the new provisions under HR 1. So in Medicaid, for example, we now are looking at a world in which there are going to be material work requirements for non-disabled, non-elderly adults who don't have young children at home. Mm-hmm. For example, so the state needs a system to enforce those work requirements. State has to now have a system where people are being reviewed for eligibility every 6 months instead of once a year. So I think the state is likely to have those things very much in the here and now, and I anticipate that we'll hear more about the state's plans in the next few months. In terms of what to do about a big revenue gap that could emerge under this provider tax change in structure, it's really hard to know. These kind of dollar estimates are, you know, these are hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Right.
Into the billions, right? And once you take into consideration, it's not just the state money that's pushed away, it's the matching federal money that you lose. I mean, this is material, but at the same time, you may have fewer people covered in your program. You know, the work requirements, for example, and the more frequent redeterminations are going to mean the enrollment decline. You're going to have fewer people. So your Medicaid expenses presumably will be diminished. So, you know, there's some offset there, but even the governor's office basically said a few months ago, we don't have estimates yet on the full interconnected impacts.
And that is something that we will be thinking about and really... You know, as you conclude in this report, we need to be concerned about this, but not necessarily worried at this point because, yeah, there right. is some time before all this kicks in. And so we know what's out there. We know kind of the political winds that are blowing in what direction for the foreseeable future. So we will see what happens. But this is important as we think about the state of our fiscal health here in Illinois. And this report is really interesting to check out. It's called Current Condition and Future Concerns for Growth in Illinois State Revenue. And Paula Worthington is a collaborating scholar on this report. And she is also the senior policy advisor at the Civic Federation. Paula, it was very nice talking to you today. Thanks for all of your work with this report. And thanks for chatting.
Thanks so much. Look forward to talking again soon.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 1004 is just about done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks, of course, to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.